So let's talk a little bit about metta. First of all, I mean, I've actually stopped using the phrase loving kindness, I have to confess. Metta comes from the Pali, maitri is the verb, the Pali verb, which is the origins, the roots of the words metta, which actually means friend, befriending. Which I actually find, because sometimes I think it's too much, almost. You know, we don't have to love something. We can befriend it. Especially in our culture, I think, where the word love has so many associations. We don't actually have to love something, but we can befriend it. In a way, the most, I think, a better translation of metta is boundless friendliness. I would also say that in one sutta, the Buddha says that there is no higher mindfulness than metta. Metta is very... I mean, it is also helpful to know that the way that we have come to know metta practice in the West, you know, with the use of the phrases repeated again and again, which is very useful practice, very wonderful practice. But it did come in much later, about 1,000 years after the Buddha's death, with Buddha Gosa. He began to organize some of the meditation instructions that the Buddha had given. And interesting, I think Buddha Gosa didn't quite know what to do with metta because he put it under concentration in the path of purification. Whereas, you know, when you look at how the metta is used in the early texts, the Buddha puts it as an underlying attitude for all meditative development. And the divisions in the early texts between, say, like metta practice, concentration practice, insight practice, they're very, very thin divisions. Because for most of us to really cultivate boundless friendliness probably requires a considerable amount of insight. And it is also true that metta, when cultivated in a very intentional way, has the effect of focusing and concentrating the mind. But it's also true for any of us to engage in insight practice that really develops, we need to have this underlying climate of befriending. Otherwise, we will not deepen in insight practice. So metta in the discourses is very succinctly described as being the antidote to dosa. Metta is the antidote to hatred, to ill will, to fear, to intolerance, to impatience. It's the antidote to the dosa that is one of the three primary tendencies that keeps us entangled in suffering, estrangement, and agitation. So metta is speaking directly to all the moments of aversion, resistance, pushing away, disconnection that keeps us alienated, that inflates the sense of self and other and the abyss between them. That much of that rests upon dosa, or ill will. The tendency that probably creates the greatest suffering in our world and is one of the most clear expressions of ignorance, is ill will. Not knowing what is true, not knowing the way things are. I think to know the mind of a Buddha, a liberated life, we are asked to uproot ill will in all its forms. I don't think there's, just think of the size of the task. But the size of the task is equal to the size of the moment. Now, the Buddha actually describes metta as a complete path to liberation, not a secondary practice. If you look in the discourses, when the Buddha speaks about 6 or 7, maybe no more, maybe 9 or 10, different doorways to liberation, metta is one of them. So it's not a kind of, add-on practice. I used to be a metta snob. I thought you did a little metta at the end of retreats, send people home with a good feeling. It was such a superficial understanding of metta. It's not an add-on practice. It is like all the paramis, an insight practice. And again, it's not about feeling a particular way, but about how our mind is when no longer governed by ill will, by our willingness not to indulge in ill will. This is metta, to befriend, to stay near to stay close to. For most of us then, to develop metta, or boundless friendliness, I think requires quite a considerable insight into all the places where aversion and hostility and fear is fostered and held. That takes a lot of honesty. Takes a lot of honesty. But it's more than this. It's also knowing for ourselves the consequences for ourselves and others of holding on to fear and aversion. To know the cost that we pay for holding on to fear and aversion, and actually to have the willingness to value freedom more deeply than we value our aversion. That's kind of a moment-to-moment reflection, isn't it? When aversion or fear or ill will arises, what do we value more in that moment, our freedom or the aversion? Because we can, it's not just that we experience aversion. We can be really attached to aversion. So it's a practice, but it's an attitude. The nature of mindfulness is to care. The nature of mindfulness is to care for. The nature, which is the beginning of a path of compassion, the nature of mindfulness is to befriend. Now, we don't have to love the difficult. We don't have to love the difficult person, the difficult experience, but we can find the courage to befriend and to be steadfast rather than to flee. And this is metta. This is metta. It's also something of a later development, I think, in meditative practice, that so much time would be given to extending metta to self. And, you know, it is, of course, one of the, you know, as much as there's huge benefits in using the different categories of metta, we need to be a little bit careful that we don't, in spending a lot of time extending metta to ourselves, forget that metta is simply about uprooting ill will, no matter where it is extended, to ourselves or to others. It's cultivating, metta is essentially cultivating a quality of heart, a quality of befriending that makes no difference between self and other. There is an equanimity thread, I think, that runs through metta, to see all beings equally, to see all beings, all events, all experiences equally. So metta is not just about people. Metta is about how we befriend events, how we befriend experience, how we befriend phenomena, how we stay near to any place in our life where there is a tendency to resist or to flee or to disconnect. So it is really clearly not just about human relationship. It is about life and where aversion and ill will arises in life. Metta has, as, and I mentioned this earlier, a very powerful relationship to ethics. Boundless friendliness essentially means friendliness without conditions. Without conditions. Longchenpa, there's this wonderful piece from the Tibetan teacher Longchenpa. He says, out of the soil of friendliness grows the bloom of compassion, watered by the tears of joy, sheltered under the cool shade of the tree of equanimity. He brings all of the Brahma Viharas together, beginning with metta.
May I ask you to read that again?
Yeah. Out of the soil of friendliness grows the bloom of compassion, watered by the tears of joy, sheltered under the cool shade of the tree of equanimity. Pretty nice, isn't it?
Who wrote that?
Long Chempa. Years ago, the Buddha identified ill will in all its forms as one of the primary causes of suffering. Whether directed inwardly or outwardly, whether directed towards people, whether directed towards experience, fracturing relationship, fracturing communities, leading to war, to conflict, to fear, to estrangement. And he equally identified metta as one of the most liberating and healing forces. It is one of the great practice challenges of our time, I think. So it is not a feeling. Metta is not an emotion. It is not a feeling. It has much more to do with an intention, an attitude, and a commitment. So metta is really dealing in many ways with our cognitive world. It's really dealing with our cognitive world because we see that the mind of ill will sees ill will. The mind of ill will lives in fear and has thoughts of ill will and is imprisoned by those thoughts. There is such a closed feedback loop in ill will. It feels ill will, sees ill will, is imprisoned by ill will, deepens ill will. So metta is really about changing the shape of our mind, changing our cognitive world, changing the very foundation of our thoughts, words, and actions. It is one of the three intentions that the Buddha talks about in this teaching, metta. To bring that intention of metta into all moments, all situations, all circumstances. That if that intention of metta is put in place, the other two intentions of compassion and renunciation are made possible. But that without metta, there is always a distance. Look how metta and mindfulness are interwoven. That this is the intention of mindfulness, as much as it is as the intention of metta. There is a certain understanding, I think, which is really important about metta. First, that it is not a feeling, but an attitude. Second, that metta has its cultivation has much to do with the altruistic sense of this path. That it is really widening the circle of our concern beyond me and mine. That it is really bringing that dedication to ending distress in all its forms. Metta is relational. It's not something that sits over there. You know, and often I think when people use, for example, the metta phrases, it would be far more helpful to make them relational. You know, maybe I be at peace with this. Maybe I find peace in the midst of ill will. May I find safety, you know, may I find kindness in the midst of aversion or with this aversion. To make metta relational, which is what it is, if it is an attitude and intention, it's not a state. And I think sometimes people get in trouble with metta practice because they're trying to make it something separate. You know, may I be peaceful when all of this is going on? May I be peaceful with this? May I be peaceful with this grief, with this sadness, with this unkindness? So it is relational rather than something separate. Metta, as I mentioned earlier on today, is a great protector, a great guardian of the mind and heart from the habitual tendencies of aversion and obsession, protecting the mind from the unwholesome. This is also one of the definitions of mindfulness, is to protect the mind. there is such an interwoven relationship between mindfulness and metta that it's almost impossible to separate. You know, one of the kind of metaphors that the Buddha uses for mindfulness is mindfulness sits on the watchtower of the gates of a city, actually determining what is helpful to enter and what is helpful to not enter. That it is the guardian of the mind. Metta has the effect of undoing habits of aversion rather than feeding them. It looks back to generosity. Metta looks back to generosity, to not withholding, and it creates an inner climate of calmness. Metta, you know, in a lot of ways, I think we underestimate this, that metta and mindfulness practice is really a development in re-educating our hearts. It's re-educating. It's re-teaching. You know, that rather than the habits that we think are so normal or so impulsive, we are re-educating, coming out of the world of accidental encounters into intentionality. So, anybody have any questions about metta, about this friendliness as a parami? Yeah.
Again and again, you have today and yesterday presented to me, I can't speak for anyone else, ways of understanding that are new and different than anything I've ever heard before. And this is another example of metta. I'm so struck by how beautiful your description is. I mean, much of that poem from Rumi about opening the doors.
Yeah, I
just have never heard this before. So. I mean, is this something that you, in studying, came upon? Or you?
Did I just make it up?
I'd ask if that was the first time I've seen you, but this is at least the 10th year I've come to retreat with you, so I don't think you made...
I study a lot, and I work with a couple of really fine Pali scholars. Who actually have a pretty, you know, pretty developed knowledge of the early texts. And this is more of a sort of upsurge, I think, in Dhamma study, that a lot of the scholars who can really understand Pali, and mine is very limited, are looking pre-Mahayana, pre-Theravada, to the earliest Nikayas, before there were any schools. Trying to discern, which I think is really wonderful, trying to discern what the Buddha actually taught. What the Buddha actually taught. And metta is something that is really embedded in the early texts, but it is often, many times, used interchangeably with mindfulness. If you even look at, you know, because there is only one metta discourse in the Sutta Nipata. I mean, that's the only place that metta is mentioned. You will only find two instances in the early discourses where actual phrases are used of may all beings, may I be happy, may you be happy. I think there's only two instances that people can find in the early discourses. But what is talked about time and time again is the essential foundation of metta as the base of all meditative development. And the interchange of the use of sati and metta.
And it seems it's the most basic understanding of creating a ground where aversion would not exist.
Exactly. I mean, what is metta for? It is the antidote to ill will.
It's just incredible.
Directly. Mm-hmm. And that is what it's concerned with. It's not concerned with good feelings. It's concerned with interrupting the movement and the momentum of ill will. And, you know, so there's huge insight in that. You know, there's huge insight in seeing the consequences of ill will, seeing the consequences of metta.
So you just did say that these were scholars looking at
Yes, so to the best of our knowledge, to the best of working knowledge at this moment.
I understand. Now, just to answer, just to ask again another question, kind of applied to what you just said, because so many of the references you've given yesterday and today are from great Tibetan teachers.
Yeah.
What is there anything in the Tibetan literature that is similar to what you're saying today?
Shantideva's guide.
Okay.
Shantideva's work. I mean, Shantideva was really the poet of compassion. The poet of compassion. And in many ways, Shantideva, he was actually Indian, but he actually brought together, collated in the most beautiful ways, the development of the paramis. If you look in the early discourses, the paramis are not collated into a collection. They are mentioned individually, they're strewn throughout the discourses, but Shantideva is the one who brought the paramis together into a collation and actually almost and began to speak about them as a path. But if you look to the early discourses, which is rather paradoxical, even though the paramis are not collated into this kind of, you know, steady list, they are mentioned as the ten. And if you look at the teaching stories in the early discourses, the Buddha talks about this momentum of lifetime to lifetime perfecting the paramis. So there's a certain paradox there. Metta is less used in the Tibetan discourses because the emphasis there is so much upon compassion, so much upon the development of compassion. There's a whole historical story about this, which actually we absolutely do not have time to go into today, about how that came to be, which would be very interesting as a history of Buddhist development. But in the Tibetan tradition, neither metta or compassion is mentioned as one of the paramis. In the Tibetan tradition, compassion is made up of the six paramis. Compassion is made up of the six paramis. They're not individual paramis in themselves. It is in the earlier discourses that you find metta as one of the paramis. Shantideva? Shantideva. Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. There are several translations. It's worth looking at the different translations because they vary differently. The translation that I particularly love is actually like a long poem. It's actually like this hugely long poem filled with verse after verse after verse. Shan, Bodhisattva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. They're all called that. All the different translations are called that. Huh? He has one. There's others. Google it. Sorry.
Yeah, the way I heard it at some point was that armies were means to develop our mind so that we would prepare ourselves for enlightenment.
Not exactly.
Okay, that's where I'm confused. I'm trying to make the leap.
First of all, let's take the word enlightenment out of the package because this is a Western introduction, right? The words in Pali are nibbana or nirodha. These words refer to blowing out the fires of greed, hatred, delusion. Enlightenment came something Western is through in this part. Never, it's not a Pali word at all. So the paramis are not so much, they are a preparation, not a preparation for awakening, they are a training in awakening, I would say. And if we look at the fruition of the paramis, we might say, what does an awakened heart look like? And that are these paramis brought to fruition so that they are unshakable. But they are practices. So they're not sort of a preparation for awakening, they're a training in liberation. You know, if you look at metta, it's a training liberating the heart from ill will. The freedom from ill will is the blowing out of one of the fires that keeps dukkha and struggle and anguish going. I wish I had a whiteboard. I would like to have a whiteboard.
I'm just trying to remember to keep in mind when I'm learning details, to keep the big picture in mind at the
yes.
same time. And it's, sometimes I get lost in the details and I can't
yeah.
remember what was the whole point of this.
Yeah. That's why I've been trying to remind you that the paramis, you know, really speaking about the perfections, what it is, two things. The fabric of compassion describes the fabric of compassion, describes the landscape of an awakened heart in which the paramis are unshakable. But before, unshakable is not a breakthrough experience. Unshakability is a fruition of training. So it's good to keep bringing it up, you know. Why are we doing this? What are we talking about here? It's because we can easily get lost in the details of each of the paramis. Paramis. I mean, I will only go to kind of what I have been told in researching those stories. I don't know this directly because, as I say, I don't know enough Pali. But in many of these stories that you hear in the suttas about sudden awakenings, if they look a little bit more deeply, they talk about actually how these paramis have been brought and developed in other ways. But anyway, I think that's a secondary. Yeah.
You mentioned that in the earliest discourses that the Buddha talked about metta as the foundation for meditative practice. And I wonder if did he say anything about how to cultivate metta?
It's not much there. I mean, if you look at the discourses, they're remarkably short on any kind of like technical advice. You know, if you look at the discourses, you know, you don't hear much mention of techniques or methods. Probably the one form, one style of meditation where there's the most kind of technical advice in the discourses. No, this is not true. I'm sorry. There's two. There's a lot of technical advice about the development of concentration states. And, of course, there's the Satipatthana Sutta, which is, you know, completely detailed advice about the development of insight. You know, absolutely so complexly detailed, which I know Rodney has spent 2 years on and can probably spend another 2 years on, because there is so much in the Satipatthana Sutta in terms of the development of insight. In metta, there is only one discourse. There's one discourse which essentially doesn't use phrases. It doesn't use any phrases. It just speaks about the sort of extending the domains of metta. And it doesn't even really mention this piece that I mentioned that I think is equally important, that metta is towards experience and not just people. Because metta is about uprooting ill will. And when we look at ill will, we can have as much ill will towards experience as we can have towards individuals. So it would be slightly delusional to think that somehow we can just have, you know, good friends everywhere and still maintain ill will towards experience over here. So boundless friendliness means without conditions in any moment that ill will arises towards anything or anyone. You know, and I think that piece often gets neglected, that we can be so busy using phrases about friends, benefactors, and difficult people that, you know, meanwhile over here we're shouting at that car in the traffic jam, you know, thinking this has got nothing to do with metta. Of course it has something to do with metta, because that's ill will in that moment. So it's not at all to dismiss the development of metta through the domains of individuals, people, but certainly not to limit it to that, I think is deeply important. I can have ill will, you know, towards the sound from this microphone. You know, meanwhile I'm delighting in my benefactor. Well, you're still ill will. You know? So that is its primary commitment to uprooting ill will.
You know, metta brought me to Buddhism. I was, I have a son who was very angry with me, and I was getting really angry back that he was so mad at me. And somebody suggested I pray for him, and they gave me the phrases of a metta prayer. Unbeknownst to me, it was Buddhism. And I started saying it all the time, and like all day long, obsessively. And within a very few days, my anger left. I wasn't angry anymore. And then I found I was led to Buddhism. And I became hooked. I learned the metta prayer and I became hooked on it. And everything changed. I mean, I had neighbors who didn't speak to each other, and suddenly I felt so different about them. I couldn't be mad about them and pray for them at the same time. And so I started smiling and waving as I walked by. But I became a little obsessed with this prayer. And I started...
Well, you use it by a prayer. You mean you're talking about a few phrases?
Yeah. The blessing or whatever, the words. It feels like a prayer, you know, may. It does feel like a prayer. Mm. You know, may you be safe from danger. May you have peace. And but I became so obsessed with it that I didn't want to leave anybody out. And pretty soon it started, I was dull in it. You know, instead of being excited, like I was for the first many, many months, I would just fly out of bed in the morning to go do my metta. And then I started going, may you be free from me. And then my mind would go off to the crows flying overhead. You know, may you be happy. You know, even forgetting who I was, you know, was it the checkup guy at the grocery store, or... Am I at the benefactor?
Well, it's easy to turn anything into a habit, including metta.
What did you say?
Easy to turn anything into a habit, including metta, including the metta phrases, which is when they become a sort of empty recitation. You know, but I would say, you know, clearly in the early parts of this, the metta was really effective in protecting your mind from ill will and in generating a certain befriending.
Mm-hmm. So you can mix it up.
Oh, absolutely. There is nothing sacred about these phrases. In fact, if we used the domains in the Metta Sutta, it would be entirely different. It would be, may all short people be well and happy. May all tall people be well and happy. You know, it would be completely different, you know.
May all men, may all women.
Yeah, it would be completely different. So there's nothing sacred about that. I mean, the virtue of the phrases is that they have a concentrating effect. Mm-hmm. They keep the mind focused, you know, they keep the mind focused, which is why it's important to keep the phrases quite simple. And it's also, I mean, I must say, you know, like when I teach metta in Italy, for example, I have to be really careful with the words, because the may I does sound like a beseeching. Mm. Where that is not how it's meant to be. Instead, it's invitational inwardly. It's invitational. Oh, may I be peaceful? Mm-hmm. Then you listen. And I think that listening part is what stops the habit forming. You know, rather than just, you know, really just repeating, you invite, then you stop and you listen. May I be peaceful? You listen inwardly. What is the response to that? That's where it's turning more into an insight practice. Because you're listening inwardly. What is the response to that? Those words? May I live with ease and with kindness? And you listen inwardly. What is the response to that? When you're in the midst of aversion, or, you know, ill will towards something or someone, may you be peaceful. Ah, I listen inwardly. What is the response to that? So it's actually making this actually quite relational, and it is turning it into an insight practice, because it's beginning the willingness to befriend the landscape of resistance and aversion and rejection. So slow it down. I would suggest slow it down. And remember events, not just people. I can't stress that enough. Can't stress that enough. You know, may I be peaceful with this aching knee? Ah, what does that mean? You know, with this sound outside the window.